Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Paramahansa Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi was one of the most impactful spiritual books of the 20th century and has traveled around the world, inspiring millions. Today's guest explores the relevance of these tales in modern times. What do spiritual aspirants steeped in technology and science, like our guest today, think of these classic tales of gurus, swamis, and miracles in the Himalayas? Our guest today is Rizwan Virk, author of the book Wisdom of a Yogi, Lessons for Modern Seekers from Autobiography of a Yogi. Rizwan is a successful entrepreneur, a video game pioneer, a venture capitalist, and the founder of the startup accelerator Play Labs at MIT. A graduate of MIT and Stanford, he is currently a faculty associate at Arizona State University. He is also the author of Zen Entrepreneurship, Startup Myths and Models, What You Won't Learn in Business School, Treasure Hunt, Follow Your Inner Clues to Find True Success, and The Simulation Hypothesis. An MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we are in a video game. And what an interesting concept that is. So I just want to say hello, Riz, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Well, thanks so much for having me on your show.
Now, as you write in your book, it says books about Yogananda are usually written by devotees, monks, journalists, or religious scholars. And I was none of those things, though I was a big fan of Yogananda's book, and it had an impact on my life. Tell us about that. What kind of impact did it have? I mean, here you are, you're a scientist, you're a left brain, you know, you've got a great left brain, you know, and this is a book about wild stories. How was it that it had such a big impact for you?
Well, you know, when I graduated from MIT with a degree in computer science all the way back in the 90s, you know, I started to live this double life for a little while, where during the day, I was running a software startup, you know, dealing with big corporations, dealing with investors and venture capitalists. And then, you know, in the evenings and on the weekends, I'd be exploring, you know, different types of meditation, different states of consciousness. I'd be jetting off to places like the Monroe Institute, you know, to try out-of-body experience. And so I was kind of living this double life. And, you know, the Yogananda's book was recommended to me by one of my earliest meditation teachers back in the 90s. And that was the first time I read it. And of course, you know, as having been kind of trained in the Western materialistic point of view, you know, there's these stories of these swamis levitating and appearing in multiple places and, you know, Babaji living hundreds of years in the Himalayas. And, you know, at first I was, you know, my first reaction was, what, did that really happen? But I think, you know, part of the purpose of this book is to inspire and to open minds. And, you know, Yogananda came here over 100 years ago. And a lot of what he was trying to do was to open minds in this, you know, predominantly Western, predominantly Christian country at the time, that there might be other ways of looking at the world. And that's what it did for me. And then, you know, years later, when I wrote a book about this idea that we live inside a video game, I had referenced Yogananda and, you know, quoted him a few times. And, you know, we can talk about that in a little bit. But what happened was, out of the blue, I ended up getting an email from someone at HarperCollins India saying that it's the 75th anniversary of the publishing of Autobiography of a Yogi, which was, you know, back in 1946. And this email was back in 2021. And they said, we'd like to write a book about lessons that, you know, someone in the modern world has learned. And we'd like you to write this book. And like you said there, my first thought was, are you sure you want me to write this book? You know, I'm a fan of Yogananda's. I mean, the whole thing kind of came about because I had gone through some health issues. And so I was sitting on the couch and I ended up rereading the autobiography, which I do every few years. And I ended up, you know, writing a few blog posts about, you know, what the book meant to me and about other books that might be like Autobiography of a Yogi. And I wasn't planning to write a book on Yogananda. I just put the blog posts up. And then as my health improved, I went back to, you know, doing the things that I did in Silicon Valley and in academia and kind of forgot about it. And so it kind of came as a bit of a shock. And, you know, one of the lessons in the book is that sometimes the universe gives you a task, right? Whether you feel ready or not. And in this case, you know, at first I was a, you know, I had a bit of a questioning. And then as I thought about it more, I got that sensation that I often get, which is like this electric sensation that says, yeah, this is actually important. This is something that I really should do, because, you know, I can give the perspective of someone kind of in the modern world, in the scientific world, in the technology world. You know, even in India today, you know, one of the biggest industries is becoming the tech industry. And so you've got a whole generation of people, right, that are growing up in a very different India than, you know, perhaps was there in the past. And so it's interesting, Yogananda is, you know, very popular there. But I've had, you know, a number of emails from people in India who said, oh, you know, I could never really get into this book because of these crazy stories. But now that I read your book, I'm taking it a little more seriously. I'm going back and I'm deciding to read, you know, more of Yogananda's autobiography, which is, of course, part of the goal here.
You know, it's not clear. I mean, it's not clear that you are like a true believer in the literal and the literal stories that are in this book. I mean, you, in a number of occasions during the reading of the book, I noticed you were saying, well, some people think, you know, he's embellishing or that these things are made up. And then you sort of make the case, but it's not super clear, that it doesn't really matter. Why doesn't it matter? Why is it important? You know, let's say he is embellishing. And I always thought that. I lived in India for a year and I met Swamis, and you know, they say there's an expression in India, they say only an enlightened being can ascertain if somebody else is enlightened, otherwise you're just not qualified to make a judgment about it. And I remember that, and I remember, well, I'm not enlightened, you know, that's not gonna I'm not qualified, but I was around people that I thought might be enlightened, like Sai Baba, who's doing a lot of magic. And Sai Baba said, he said, the magic's not, or the materializations are not important, but I give you what you want so that you may come to want what I have come to give. And I always thought that was a little disingenuous. And it sounds like that's kind of the same kind of thing here.
Well, you know, I'm not taking a strong stand either way. You know, some of those stories were the most memorable to me. And, you know, I didn't even have to reread the book to remember them. And in some of them, Yogananda goes through great pains to tell us, you know, the provenance of the story and why he thinks it may have been real. You know, some people have accused Yogananda of basically taking, you know, ideas out of the Arabian Nights, right? Uh-huh. Where you have like genies who show up and they materialize a palace in the Himalayas. And so, you know, my point is that these stories are interesting. They display potential yogic powers, but they usually have a message about karma in there. And they're usually also to teach us a lesson. And I'll give you an example. Speaking of the Arabian Nights, you know, one of the stories that really stood out in my mind was the one of the Muslim fakir named Afzal Khan, who, you know, was able to control this entity, which he called Hazrat, and which I interpret as a genie or a jinn, you know, in the Western traditions, just because that's, you know, coming out of the Islamic traditions. And turns out Hazrat could make any object appear or disappear, right? And so when Yogananda's guru, Sri Yukteswar, visited him in his dorm room when he was going to Serampore College, which, by the way, Yogananda didn't want to do, but his guru made him go to finish at least 2 years of an associate's degree in college because he had the inclination that his big task in life might be to go to the West, and education was important. We can talk more about that in a minute as well. But so it was, you know, when Yukteswar was in his dorm room in that hostel, he said, in this very building, I saw this Muslim fakir performed 4 miracles, right? And they had to do with an object that appeared and disappeared. In one case, they had to do with a giant feast of golden platters falling from the ceiling with cooked biryani, you know, things that just sound pretty fantastical. Well, if you delve into that story, you know, Afzal Khan, when he was a kid, supposedly met this Hindu yogi who, you know, he helped out by giving him some water at a time when there was a lot of sectarian differences between Muslims and Hindus. And so the yogi said he would reward him partly because of his past karma with teaching him a yogic technique that would allow him to control this entity. But he also warned him and he said, because of your past life tendencies, you know, try to use this power for good and not for your personal benefit.
Right.
because you had these greedy tendencies. And so Afzal Khan ended up becoming greedy, and he would like touch, you know, jewelry in a store, and then he'd go out and Hazrat would supposedly make the jewelry disappear and reappear in his hands. And so, you know, he became known as the Terror of Bengal, because jewelry stores would try to shut their doors when they saw him coming, as would railroad stations, because he would go and get like 50 tickets for his students simply by just touching the tickets. And whenever somebody accused him of anything, Hazrat would make the tickets disappear. And so, you know, later he encountered this old man who was lame, who had a golden ball. And the old man asked him to heal him using his powers, but instead he used Hazrat to steal the ball. And it turns out the old man was the same yogi that, you know, he had encountered when he was a kid. And he goes, so it's true. You've used these techniques, you know, to be greedy. And so he made Afzal Khan, you know, do this big apology in the newspaper, in one of the newspapers in Bengal. And he took away the power for him to control Hazrat, except for a few circumstances. Now, what are we to think of this story, right? I mean, first of all, it's an incredible story. I mean, it certainly stood in my mind. But I think, you know, the important part is not just whether it happened. And I, you know, have looked for investigation of other stories like this. And turns out there are other stories like this in the yogic traditions and in the Islamic traditions, you know, in the city of Lahore, where I'm from. But here is a story about karma, right? So if your karma was that you had a tendency to be greedy or avaricious, and let's say you were in a video game, and in that video game, you needed to get the perfect quest or the perfect test for whether you're going to be greedy or not. What would be a better test than giving you the ability to get any piece of gold or object or riches that you wanted, right? And that's the ability that he got. And so we see in this, woven into this story, is a lesson about how karma works, in that the great engine of karma creates situations for us that are perfect for our particular karmic script and our particular karmic challenges. And so I think that is the important part of the story. Now, that said, you know, I did look into other stories, as I mentioned, and there are other stories where, you know, for example, Swami Rama of the Himalayan Institute talks about meeting a guy who was able to make an object from far away appear. Like he said, I'd like, you know, dinner from the hotel, so the Savoy Hotel in London, and automatically, you know, all the silverware and these napkins and things that said the Savoy Hotel appeared. And, you know, so all of these stories, they do sound incredible, and I'm not saying that they couldn't have happened. In fact, you know, the more I look into it, the more I realize they certainly could have happened. But I think the point for Yogananda to put these in the autobiography was not just to show us, hey, if you do a certain yogic technique, you could control a genie. I don't think that's what he wanted us to learn. It was the karmic lesson for that story. You know?
Right, right. So it was published in 1946. And it really got traction in the 60s. And it was not a book about asanas or how to do yoga. It was, I don't know how you might characterize it, as kind of a book of sort of like a popularizing Hinduism or yoga or the yoga tradition through the agency of these stories. And was that Yogananda's purpose? Was it primarily a PR thing?
Well, I don't know if it was primarily a PR thing, but that was definitely part of Yogananda's purpose, right? And so, you know, Yogananda, when he was a relatively young monk, was teaching in the school in Ranchi, these young boys. It was a boys' school based on Vedic principles. And, you know, he had this vision of these Caucasian faces. And, you know, he took these to be Americans, even though he had never met an American, right? And he ended up saying, okay, I'm being called to America, right? He took that clue very seriously, that vision. He went to Calcutta, back to the city, and he was invited to speak at a religious conference in Boston in 1920. Now, at that point in time, he was not the best person for this task, right? I mean, he was a young Swami. He said he had rarely ever given a public lecture. He had never given a public lecture in English. Right. And you couldn't exactly consider him fluent in English. And so, you know, perhaps an older Swami who had traveled more, who had spoken in English, might have been a better representative. But yet that was the task that was placed in front of him, as his guru and others told him, you know, the time is now or never. And that became his life mission, which was to bring the yoga and philosophy of the East to the West. And initially, you know, he did that by going crisscrossing the country, right? When he was young, he had this image of these yogis in the Himalayas, and this image thrilled him. And he always thought he was going to be a wandering yogi in the Himalayas. And there's tons of stories in the autobiography when he was a boy and he would try to run away, you know, to go to the Himalayas. But he did end up becoming a wandering monk, just not in the Himalayas. He ended up becoming a wandering monk in America, and he crisscrossed the country on automobiles and on trains and buses back then, not so much planes during Yogananda's day. But then he had some setbacks. And, you know, one of the lessons that I try to draw out, if you read his autobiography, you think, oh my God, everything just happened so miraculously for him. Well, no, he had a lot of challenges during his life. And at one point, there was a big scandal involving his number two guy, Swami Dhirananda, who an irate husband of one of the women taking yoga classes in LA came and bopped the Swami on the nose. Meanwhile, Yogananda was on the road, and then the Hearst newspaper started publishing stories, you know, about, you know, all this untoward stuff that was happening in these dark rooms with these American women chanting and Hindus, sex cults and stuff, which, of course, none of which was going on. But of course, Yogananda got blamed for that, even though he was traveling, and he couldn't even give his talk in Miami because the husbands of the women that were going to attend, you know, were going to come and physically beat him up. And the police basically had to tell him, no, you can't have this. And so, you know, after that, his organization kind of fell apart. And so he was looking for a different way to bring his message back. I mean, he went to Mexico and he meditated and he was saying, Lord, can I just go back to India? This is too hard. I just want to go back and I want to meditate. Right. After he had spent so many years crisscrossing the country, giving lectures that thousands of people had attended. And I think that that setback actually had the impact of having him look for a different way to spread the message. So he spent the next 10 years in Encinitas, near San Diego, on the Pacific Ocean, where there's the Encinitas Hermitage of SRF, and he wrote this book. And so that became a key part of, I think, how he wanted to accomplish his life's mission and how he wanted to spread that.
Yeah. Do you know what his lectures were about before he started writing the book in 36 or whenever? I mean, what was it? What, he was going around the country. What were his lectures? Were they the stories? Was he telling these stories, or was he, what was the content? Do you know?
Well, you know, some of them I've know, and there's books that, you know, that SRF has published that has some of his lectures in there. And, you know, The Science of Religion is one that he would talk about. The Battle of Life. Now, Yogananda was teaching, again, to a primarily Christian audience. So oftentimes he would, if you read the autobiography, you'll notice there's a lot of biblical passages in there that he's tying to the Hindu Vedas. Mm-hmm. And so you know, he was trying to show people that yoga was not just a religion, part of the Hindu religion, but that it was sort of the underlying science of finding God. And so how to find God. There's a great picture of Yogananda in 1920s. Early 20s in Boston, which is where he lived for a few years. You know, he has this long hair. He has on kind of a robe, and there's a little a sign that has, you know, Swami Yogananda lectures about the mind, the mysteries of the mind, or something like that, right? And so, you know, he wasn't above using these kinds of gimmicks to say and doing demonstrations of strength, of yogic strength on the stage. But always his lesson was that, you know, yoga was a technique for you to find God and for you to find self.
And interestingly, he opened it up for householders, because in India, you know, they've got a kind of like a division of labor. You know, the monks do the spiritual work, and the people feed the monks, and, you know, it's pretty the regular people are not meditating. You know, and when I lived in India for a year, and I realized that there were more people meditating in California than the entire country of India. At least I was told that, and I thought, you know, and it seemed true from what I could observe. What about Steve Jobs? You know, you mentioned the fact in your book, something that I'd never heard before, that Steve Jobs, this is one of his favorite books, in that he read it every year. Did he ever have anything to say about it?
You know, he said, you know, a number of things about it to different people, including his biographer. And so not only did he reread it every year, but at his memorial service, right, the last thing he had to say about this was, you know, after his funeral, there was a memorial service held at Stanford. And we learned this from the CEO of Salesforce.com, who's a good friend of Steve's. And he said they gave out this little brown box to everybody who attended the memorial service. And he took this brown box home and he opened it up. And what was inside but a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi, right? And you know, his biographer said that when he visited him in 2011, he showed him his iPad, and that was the only book that was on his iPad.
Oh.
Now, you know, so it was kind of interesting. So Steve Jobs reread this book every year. He actually, interestingly enough, he first really started doing that when he went to India. And so one of the lessons that in my book, Wisdom of a Yogi, that I bring out from Yogananda stories, but also from Steve Jobs and others, is that you don't have to go to the Himalayas, right? And so
Right.
Steve Jobs, you know, went to India as a young man. I think he was maybe 19 at the time. And in his dorm room, he went all the way there, and somebody had left a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi, right? So that's where he read it, which was written in LA, right? Or in San Diego.
Right.
So, you know, he came back, and that became, you know, the book that he read every year. And he did a different kind of practice. So, you know, the book didn't necessarily always recruit people into the specific practices that Yogananda did. But so for Steve Jobs, and I've heard from others that, you know, from who knew his sister, that he, like George Harrison of the Beatles, would literally give out copies of this book to
I
people,
see.
right? When he met people. So it made a huge impact on his life, I think.
Now, one of the interesting things, one of the particularly interesting things in your book, and there's a lot of interesting things in your book, I really enjoyed it, but this the intersection between technology and spirituality that you explore, because that's representative of who you are and where you're at. And you talk about how technological metaphors have helped people you understand ancient concepts, and in fact, teachers have referred to radio and TV as metaphors for how the images in our mind and how our thoughts appear on the screen of consciousness, et cetera. And you've done is you've taken it further than that. And of course, I've heard computers talked about that way too, the programming of software, et cetera. But now you were your field of expertise was interactive, immersive, multimedia, as in video games. So tell us how that is a metaphor for the spiritual evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think that when sages try to explain to us the nature of reality, they always use metaphors, right? This was true, you know, 5,000 years ago when the Vedas were written by the rishis. You know, they used the term Maya or illusion. They used the term Leela, or the play of the gods, or
Right.
the game, right? And some have used the stage play, going back to Shakespeare. The dream is used often, right? It was used within the Buddhist traditions, where when somebody asked the Buddha, you know, what are you after he achieved enlightenment, he said, "I am Buddha, I am awake," basically is what he was trying to say, right? Which meant he was asleep and dreaming. And so that metaphor has been used quite a bit. And so Yogananda actually, you know, updated his metaphor to the latest technology of the time. And he was a bit of a reformer himself. I mean, you mentioned this idea of the householders, and some of the traditionalists didn't like the things that Yogananda did in India, even though he's more famous now there than ever, because, you know, he was teaching large classes as opposed to one-to-one. But at one point he saw the suffering of World War I in a newsreel, and he said, "Lord, how could you allow this suffering?" Right? They didn't call it World War I; they called it the Great War, because it was the first mechanized war, and so many people were dying. And he got a clear answer during his meditation, which is that, you know, what you're seeing is a play of light and dark, like a light and shadow. It's like a movie projector, and the people, you know, certainly the actors in a movie suffer, the characters suffer, but the actors don't die. Right, they go on, and that the whole world is like a movie. And so he would use that metaphor with his students, that it is like a movie projector. Look at the light, look away from the screen, right? And so I believe if Yogananda were alive today, he would be attuned to the latest technology. And today he would say something like, "Well, life is like a movie. We're all the actors. We have a script, but we have the choice to change the script, right? And we're also in the movie, but we're watching the movie. And what does that sound like? You know, we're playing characters. It sounds like a highly interactive, massively multiplayer online role-playing game where
Right.
we take on a character in a video game. It's even called an avatar, right? So if you and I are in a video game together, we have our avatars that are our characters, and we play that character, and we go through the life of that character. And so, you know, my background is in computer science and video games, and it kind of led me to this conclusion that life is like, you know, a computer simulated video game, like in the Matrix, but where each of us is both a player and each of us has a character, and that our body is that character.
Well, we're just about running out of time, and I mean, that's fascinating, that's multiplayer game where we actually have some agency and we're kind of co-creating with the divine. It's a very sophisticated metaphor, and I really appreciated that. That was some new information that came with this book that was really fascinating, and I wish we had more time to talk about it. And there's like 14 lessons. You break down the 14 lessons of the various stories that Yogananda shared in the autobiography, and you say that the key lesson is that you need to practice yoga of some kind every single day. It doesn't even matter how long you spend at it, as long as you spend some time each day renewing your connection with the divine. And so, on that note, I'm just going to ask you for a brief message to our audience. Is there anything that you'd like to share in closing?
Sure. Well, so if you look at the definition of yoga from Patanjali, it wasn't about the asanas. It was about stopping the whirlpools of thought and feeling in the river of consciousness. And that's what yoga was. And so if we're able to stop these storms that go within our field, within our minds, we're able to see more clearly. We're able to perceive like a snow globe that if you shake it all day, you're not going to be able to see what's in there. You let it settle, and it doesn't matter whether you do asanas, you do meditation, you go for a nice walk by the ocean or the lake. If it clears your mind and it puts you in that state, then it's a type of yoga. And so that is one of the key lessons that I think Yogananda wanted to impart to us.
I love that. And that's what I love about the yoga tradition is it assumes that you're basically good and all you got to do is let go of the silt and the static that can get in the way. Well, thank you, Rizwan. There's so much more we could explore, but we have run out of time today, and I want to make sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.zenentrepreneur.com. Now, Zen Entrepreneur is all one word, .com, and people can find out more about the book, more about you and your work at that website. So, thanks again for being with us today, and
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank our listeners. And for those who may have tuned in late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, even if you were late, you can play and share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. And I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Rizwan Virk, author of Wisdom of a Yogi, Lessons for Modern Seekers, from Autobiography of a Yogi. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. And even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled DiviNation.com, as well as via iTunes, Paulo's YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Rizwan Virk, our guest today on Pathways, and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.